And welcome to another episode of the Sea Control Podcast, your moment of PowerPoint rehab from the Center for International Maritime Security. I am, as always, your semi-helpful host, Matthew Hippel, Director of Online Content for SimSec. And we've got a bit of a long podcast today, so I will be quick. Today's topic is North Korea, the interview, and cyber warfare. We are talking to Jake Beber from the SimSec Writer Pool, Clay Aiken of the Australian Strategic Policy Institute, as well as Haley Channer of the same. There is a prize at the bottom of this podcast cereal box today after you've eaten all of your healthy Special K full of knowledge. After the podcast ended, Haley wanted to talk about how Kim Jong-il and Un could make for the ultimate Bond villain, and we were still recording, luckily enough. And somehow we got from that into how it's really unsafe to be on trains and terrible video game remakes as well as 60s fun fairs. So that's a special treat there at the end of the podcast for those who wait. But that's enough about that. You don't need to be told what the podcast is going to have in it. You're about to listen to it. So sit back, relax, and we'll be back after this short break.
Do you like the Sea Control Podcast? Sure, we all do. However, we're only a small sea in the ocean of content available to you, our dear listener, at the SimSec website. Sign up for a membership at www.cinsec.org/about/membership. China may have a 9-dash line, but our seas are clear, and we welcome your opinions and articles. Please take a moment while downloading this podcast to leave us a 5-star rating and a comment. We need them. Seriously, how do you think we pay this electric bill? Money?
And welcome back to another episode of the Sea Control Podcast. This is the special What Happened While Hippel Was Unconscious in the Hospital episode, when I was rear-ended by a Camry and woke up to find out that the interview movie had been canceled. So, you know, I thought it'd be nice to go over everything and get brought at, back up to speed. But I have a really good podcast today. I've got three fantastic guests. From ASPI, I've got Haley Channer. From the SimSec Writer Pool, we have the incredibly wise Jake Beber. And what's really just, I can't believe we have this guest today. We have the former congressional candidate and runner-up for the second season of America's Got Talent or something like that. I'm not big into pop, but I know Clay Aiken is a really famous guy. I have no idea why he's an expert on cybersecurity. But Clay, you know, hey, it's so great to have you here. Tell us a little bit about yourself.
Well, thanks for having me. It's great to be here. I'm Clay Aiken, but spelled differently.
On
the
team
down here at ASPI. Sorry?
I said, I'm sorry.
yeah, unfortunately not, although everyone likes to make fun of me for my name, so it's all good. So yeah, I'm on the cyber team down here. We look obviously at Australian cyber policy developments, but we're also trying to build ourselves as a hub for Asia-Pacific thinking on cyber. And obviously, as our topic today is going to show, it's a very active region, so we're really excited to look into it.
All right, perfect. And we'll shift back here to the States. Jake, go ahead. Where are you coming from? What are your thoughts? What's your background? What does the audience need to know about you?
Hey, good evening. My name is Jake Beber. I'm a lieutenant information warfare officer stationed at U.S. Cyber Command. So I've had been there for about a year now, and I came my previous command was 7th Fleet, so I have some familiarity with the Asia-Pacific region as well. So this is quite an interesting turn of events over the last few weeks.
Yeah, exactly. And of course, for your courtesy, of course, all comments that you make are not representative of the United States Navy, the government, or your current place of employment, and you're speaking informally as merely an enthusiast and not a professional in any official capacity. Is that good for you?
Thanks for that, yeah.
You're welcome. In case there's somebody out there in the chain of command that likes North Korea, I don't know, and this podcast bothers them for some reason. And finally, we have Haley, and Haley, I am told that we should be calling you Chan Chan.
Yeah, that's my nickname.
Well, anyways, was an awkward pause. Yeah, Natalie told that you would try to kill us if I called you Chan Chan.
No, I like it.
Anyways, Haley Chandler is also from ASPI. And Haley, if you would do us the same pleasure, kind of tell us where you're from, what brought you into this field of study, and what the audience needs to know about you.
Sure. Well, I've always been fascinated with North Korea. I've been studying it very closely since 2011, when I wrote a piece on the humanitarian impact of North Korea's nuclear weapon program. And since joining ASPI, I've done a few reports on North Korea, including its nuclear weapon development and also looking at the politics in North Korea, and very interested in the new movie, The Interview, and the reaction to it.
Which is a great place to start off. So, Haley, you are the North Korea expert, and to anyone out there that's been living under a rock, there's a James Franco and Seth Rogen movie where they go out and they try to quote-unquote interview Kim Jong-un, and I'm sorry if this is a spoiler alert, but they try to kill him. It's kind of the whole theme of the movies. This movie's come out, and there's been accusations that North Korea did a major cyber attack on Sony, and the movie's still come out, and now South Korean groups are talking about putting it in little balloons and flying it over North Korea so that people can watch it. And Haley, I was wondering if you could go a little bit into how North Korea has been reacting, or at least maybe what the internal dynamics have been in the country in reaction to this movie.
Yeah, sure. Well, look, North Korea's reaction was very strong, much stronger than actually when Team America was released a few years ago. And the North Korean government said that it was a most wanton act of terrorism and war, and said that if the U.S. government allowed the film to proceed, there would be merciless countermeasures. So North Korea is often known for threatening the United States. And although it has denied these cyber attacks, the U.S. government has linked the attacks to North Korea because of some other cyber attacks that happened to South Korea a few years ago. I think really the most interesting part about the reaction to the movie is how it speaks to how the regime views the portrayal of its leader, Kim Jong-un, and how it wants to protect the cult of personality around him. And I'm not sure if you're familiar with a book that was written last year. It's called Dear Leader. And it was written by Jang Jin-sung, who was actually one of the key propagandists of the North Korean regime until he defected in 2004. But he had some really interesting things to say about the film. Because when I first heard it was coming out, and, you know, the possibility of actual North Koreans seeing the film was raised, I thought if they ever did get to see the film, they would just see it as complete Western propaganda. But actually, Jang Jin-sung, who's the defector, he actually had a very different take on it and said that it would have quite an impact if it was seen in North Korea, because it would challenge the regime and it would challenge Kim Jong-un as being this godlike figure.
It's interesting that you bring that up, because having watched the two films, and I'm sorry for the Australians in the audience and both here on the panel, I understand that you guys can't watch it yet, which is a travesty. You bring up Team America, and you bring up, in context of the interview, is that the Team America, even though Kim Jong-il loses, is that he's still shown as rather insidious and pretty clever because of his massive plan. The whole concept of the interview is that Kim Jong-un is just an overpowered jackass. Really, ultimately. He's just an incredibly brutal, not particularly clever, just normal asshole of a guy who has incredible power. So I wonder if maybe, Haley, if you'd think if that sort of affected the view of... Is that really just... Is that too subtle a difference? Is that really just mincing, or would you think that would make a difference in how they would react to the film?
So, yeah, that is a really interesting point. I think it does matter how you create a villain, because we have seen a lot of movies in the past that have assassinated dictators or sought to assassinate people. For instance, Inglourious Basterds, where it assassinates Hitler in that sort of revisionist history. But I think it is a very interesting point about who you choose to turn into a villain. There's a Columbia University professor, Charles Armstrong, who had a very interesting point, and that was that popular culture needs something that appears threatening but doesn't seem as immediately threatening. And he brings up the case of ISIL and the fact that it would be very hard to make a movie that was a funny comedy about ISIL because it is really seen as a threat, whereas Kim Jong-un isn't seen as a threat. He's more made into a joke. And there's a big debate going on now about whether or not we should be making fun of North Korea and Kim Jong-un and whether or not that is actually masking the country's serious human rights violations and nuclear weapon development. But, you know, whether or not you should make a joke out of North Korea and the leader, I mean, I think we've all seen things like the Kim Jong-un looking at things Tumblr, and there's the Kim Jong number un Twitter account, which posts some really funny things.
I follow them,
I don't think that you shouldn't find humor in North Korea necessarily, because I don't think that detracts in itself from the human rights abuses. I mean, for instance, we take Robert Mugabe quite seriously, but Zimbabwe's human rights record doesn't get much more attention because of it. So I think there's not really a correlation between those two things, and making something humorous is a coping mechanism as well, to make a funny thing out of a really poor situation. So yes, I think you're going to have people making fun of Kim Jong-un, and in the end, this movie has got a lot of attention onto a lot of things, including cybersecurity and the human rights abuses, so really more attention is good.
So speaking of making a parody of a potential threat and possibly undermining your appreciation of that threat through parody, Jake or Clay, either one of you can take this. There has been doubts on whether or not this was conducted by North Korea. The U.S. government insists that it is. There's a lot of cybersecurity experts out there that do say, hey, this was North Korea. Norse just came out and said, no, this was definitely an inside job. You know, looking at the pictures that come out of North Korea, you see the clownish pictures of the person sitting at a blank computer that's not plugged in, typing away for the reporter, and the political commissar doesn't even realize what's supposed to be going on. We look at that, and that's how we view, I think, North Korean cyber capabilities, or at least their advancement in computer systems. Maybe the two of you, either one of you can grab it first, can talk about North Korea's capabilities or whether you think this is something that they could pull off.
Well, I think this is certainly something they could pull off. I don't want to get involved in a debate between, you know, whether or not they actually did it or not, just because of where I am, but they certainly have shown themselves to be fairly capable. And it kind of speaks to, I think, one of the issues around cyberspace, which is that the gap between knowledge and capabilities, it closes very quickly, no matter where you are, whether you're talking about North Korea or Al-Shabaab or anybody like that. That type of knowledge is pretty easy to come by. And so I wouldn't put it past anybody to be able to develop those kind of technologies and develop the tools and capabilities on a fairly quick basis to be able to conduct this type of operation.
And Klee, what about you? What's the extent of North Korean cyber capabilities? We usually talk about China or Russian cyber criminals. This is kind of an interesting new take, because North Korea is, like we said, not really someone that we typically suspect of being able to conduct a cyber assault like this.
From my perspective, it's all open source, and even the intel organizations have a bit of trouble sussing out North Korea's actual capabilities. But despite the fact that when you look at the general population and the economy and things like that, it's not driven through the internet and not driven by cyber capabilities, they do have a very dedicated core group of individuals that they're training in cyber defense and cyber offensive attacks. They've had, I guess this is speculative, but they've had training from Russia and from China, supposedly. So they do have the capabilities. They are funneling some of their best and brightest into cyber capabilities, and they see it as a it's a great asymmetric tool to use against South Korea, especially. Not necessarily to attack them to create damage, but just to delegitimize the South Korean government, or they can attack Japan, they can attack the United States. So it's a really useful tool for them to have, and they take it very seriously, even though we don't see them as an internet power as an entire nation. They do have these capabilities.
I'll throw this question that occurs to the three of you, and anyone can go ahead and grab this. But you talk about their best and brightest being focused into this one capability. How do we think that works? Because the internet is sort of where you're exposed to the wealth and speed of the rest of the world as compared to North Korea. Or would these individuals just be so indoctrinated that they wouldn't be leaned by this? Or they bought out and essentially incentivized to think, well, you know what, this country's garbage, but this is my meal ticket, so why not? Because, you know, this is not some sort of, you know, this is not a Spetsnaz unit that's the new Soviet man. These are people that are almost trained to exist in the place that is the West's greatest advantage, which is high-speed exchange of information that's very open and that generates such incredible amounts of wealth. I mean, how would you sustain in a place like North Korea such a strong and capable core of folks that do this kind of in-depth cyber work?
I think it goes beyond just the people doing cyber work. Generally, the people who do have the internet in North Korea are the elite. A lot of the elite do have access, and the reason that it doesn't necessarily corrupt them, perhaps it corrupts some of them, is that they are a part of this elite status. And I think Haley probably can shed light onto that a little bit more, about how the elite have so much more privilege that's how they're bought into it.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, they get a lot more privileges than the regular people, and they do they are supported through servers in China, I believe. So it's still very hard, though, to determine where attacks come from. And there are some cyber experts that aren't convinced that the attacks on Sony did originate from North Korea, which I find interesting as well.
I'm glad you mentioned that issue of the Chinese servers and sort of leaning towards that overall sort of that shadow that people are realizing, which is all this what happened, if it did come from North Korea, went through China. Haley, you could probably talk best about this. Does China, and I'm sure there's not very much information about this, does China do a lot to control North Korea's cyber activities or even their access? There's this suggestion being made in the media that the response to North Korea of a few weeks ago was done either by the United States or potentially China to control their, you know, petulant junkyard dog that North Korea is. What are we looking at is how does China interact with this? Because it's very weird, the North Korean internet. Just saying it just feels weird. But what's China's piece in this puzzle when it comes to containing or possibly empowering the North Koreans in the realm of cyber warfare?
Look, all indications are that it's a very difficult relationship between China and North Korea. China needs North Korea as a buffer on its border, and it's also trying to stem the flow of any North Korean refugees over the border. So there is a relationship there, and there's lots of trade that happens along the China-North Korea border. So, I mean, North Korea, especially with its nuclear tests, creates a major thorn in the side of China and is an embarrassment for China on the international stage, especially at a time when Beijing is really trying to be a responsible global actor. You have North Korea just not behaving well. And I think there's a major opportunity coming up for China to really start to put some strength on North Korea through the UN Security Council and the latest human rights report that was released last year on North Korea. China could actually vote to refer North Korea to the ICJ and have North Korea brought to account for its human rights abuses. So I think there is an opportunity for China, but again, it's in its own interest to make sure that the North Korean regime remains stable so that China doesn't have to contend with a major refugee crisis.
Let's talk very quickly about the embarrassment of North Korea for China, and then we'll move on. We talked earlier about the Liu elites, but today, actually, New York Times came out and had mentioned that China's issued a formal diplomatic complaint to North Korea because a soldier that was fleeing from starvation from North Korea killed four Chinese citizens while he was trying to get some food. So, you know, we talk about even the elites in the society, and I realize that North Korea's military is very large, but, you know, those would be the people that are preferred over the general polity, and even then, those folks are running across the border and causing a mess for China. So even if the regime did not collapse, you know, this could still be something bad for China. But I heard somebody's breath kick up right there. Now, I'm sorry for interrupting you to throw that in there, but somebody had a point.
Yeah, I just wanted to say real quick, you know, that China obviously has a stake in this. There are only four internet connections for North Korea. And they all run through China. They're provided by China Unicom. So whether or not, you know, China is directly implicated in this or not, they certainly have a stake in what's happening. And I think, you know, Haley raises some very good points about some of the diplomatic and foreign policy issues that the Chinese are trying to wrestle with here.
And speaking of which, Clay, we can move into your expertise, which is more into the realm of the American reaction. So we've talked about North Korea. We've talked about how they've reacted. We've talked about China's involvement with these actions by North Korea. So, Clay, why don't you go into a little bit about what you think is important about the American reaction, what sort of precedents it sets, what it actually consists of, and where we're trying to go with this pressure, what we want to happen from it.
Well, the American reaction actually helped China quite a bit, if you think about it. They've recently come out telling the U.S. and North Korea, let's calm down, let's lower tensions, and they're coming out as the reasonable party. And really what happened with the U.S. reaction is Sony got attacked, all the issues with threats against theaters and whatnot, and the White House completely overstepped the initial reaction. Whether or not the FBI's evidence of North Korea being responsible is credible or not, they immediately stepped in. They changed the issue from a corporate matter and a crime matter into a national security matter, which was it put President Obama into a bit of a spot, and that's really what I feel is driving some of these reactions. We're putting more sanctions onto North Korea, even though they're the most sanctioned country on earth. They're not really going to have effect, but politically speaking, the White House needs to act because they called it right from the beginning a serious national security matter, and even though they rolled back to call it cyber vandalism, the stakes were set pretty far. Congress is breathing down their neck. The American people want to see a response. So really, the White House has been put in kind of a pickle, and it's going to take quite a bit of political juggling to make this a positive outcome rather than a continuing ratcheting up of tensions.
Now, quickly, before we move into more of that discussion on the policy implications and what it means, what's considered cybercrime, what's considered a cyber attack, etc., you bring up the sanctions, and I think this is worth bringing up. So we think of sanctions. When people hear sanctions, they think of something big. But you said it yourself. This is the most sanctioned country on the planet. And I think I read that these sanctions apply to 10 officials in North Korea. And what I read was they also apply to North Korea's intelligence agencies and their arms producers, which I would imagine are already sanctioned to the maximum amount that you could possibly sanction those specific groups. So what, Clay, what do the sanctions actually consist of?
To be honest, I from what I've read, a lot of the sanctions are just rehashing of sanctions that were lowered in previous discussions around the nuclear program and things like that. So it's just small increases and decreases that are negotiated around the five-party talks and things like that. And, you know, the whole issue of putting them back on the list of state sponsors of terrorism, it's all show, really, from my perspective. Not really going to have a big effect. Maybe if we were dealing with with a different country, it could influence their leadership a little bit. But at this point, it's all an act, it seems like.
But what could affect them? Looking at what the United States has done, and as Clay, you've said, this is sort of a rehash. We're already talking about a group of elites that use their entire country's resources to support themselves, so there's not much you can take away from them unless it's their access to Netflix. Or I think at one point, Kim Jong-il, he had we sanctioned melons because he really liked them, and that drove him nuts. So, you know, interesting uses of sanctions when you're scraping the bottom of the barrel. What can we do to affect North Korea when we've taken so much away from them already?
Yeah, Matt, I'm sure I could weigh in on this one. I mean, the Obama administration has really been pushing the whole idea of strategic patience with North Korea, which in my mind just means waiting and, you know, hoping something will change. And I think it's a pretty poor strategy, especially when you have a country that has lived through sanctions for almost six decades now. So I think actually what's needed is a change in tact, and that really we do need to engage North Korea in talks. North Korea has been asking for talks for a while now, and the precondition the US has put on it is that there needs to be a total halt to all of North Korea's nuclear weapon development. Now, North Korea really has only two options. It can stop developing its nuclear weapons and talk to the US, or it can tinker away for years on its nuclear weapon development. And so the second option there is what North Korea has chosen, and it continues to impoverish its people. And really, we've just given North Korea all the time that it needs. So I actually think that engagement could work, not in the sense that it will change North Korea's behavior, but actually in the sense that it will delay North Korea's nuclear weapon and missile development. I think we saw this in 1994 with the agreed framework that was negotiated under Clinton. And although that wasn't a success, I think it actually achieved something, and that was to delay North Korea's development. And I actually think that's the best hope that we can have. And Matt, as you mentioned earlier in the podcast about having NGOs sending balloons over the North Korean border to provide information and DVDs and money actually to North Koreans, I think that trickle of information into North Korea is getting bigger, and that actually we can hopefully wait them out until there are some really larger internal problems. And that would really put more pressure on the regime than anything else.
One of the things that guides the way that we act, decides whether we do sanctions, we do talks, we do strikes with any country, or we engage in open conflict, we start a war, is how we define what other countries do to us. And Jake, what I wanted to throw to you is this question that Clay had brought up earlier: is it cybercrime? Is it a cyber attack? Is it an act of war? And I would say, just to lead to open the topic, I think there's a lot of legitimacy to saying that this is a national security issue, because if someone had come up, and I think someone said that equipment in Sony's headquarters was destroyed, like actually disabled by this attack, is if someone had done that with a missile, you would say, oh, this is a military strike, but this is a cyber attack. So, or cyber crime, you know, someone breaking into your house and destroying all your stuff. How do we define this? You know, Jake, because you and I are, though we speak not in official capacity in our uniforms, everyone listening, you know, this is a craft that we take seriously, and it's a profession that we're both in. Where do you think that line of warfare or strikes, or what's the difference between crime and someone starting that ball down the road to conflict? Where does that start, and how do we define it?
Yeah, you raise an excellent point, and I think this at this time, you know, this is an opportunity for policymakers, civilian elected policymakers, to finally grapple with some of these issues that we've just not yet had the will to handle. I mean, let's face it, it is a lot easier today for the skipper on one of your ships, Matt, or from a sub, or to fire a Tomahawk or drop a JDAM or fire a Hellfire into a tent full of terrorists and kill a bunch of people than it is for me at Cybercom to send some electrons downrange. And that's one of the issues that we've got to deal with. We have to look at the policy issues involving information sharing between the public and private sector. who owns what and how much, the issues of personal privacy, that when you start talking about data that's flowing across all of these networks and the potential to conduct these type of cyber operations, whether they're full-blown attacks or simple what you want to call ISR or OPE or operational preparation in the environment. I don't mean to throw out acronyms out there. These types of things are going on in a new era where, policy just boggles me sometimes about what we can and cannot do. And is this a law enforcement matter? You know, I think Clay was bringing up a good point. You know, what was a cyber attack 2 days ago suddenly has become cyber vandalism. And all I can picture is Kim Jong-un, you know, spray painting graffiti on a bridge somewhere in DC. And I'm like, really? This is what we're up against now? But it kind of reminds me of some of the issues we faced in some of the earlier terrorist attacks, not only 9/11, but also in the World Trade Center in 93. Is that a law enforcement issue, or is that a issue that requires a serious response, you know, from a military perspective? I mean, personally, I think that we've got to kind of break the Title 50, Title 10 mindset, that kind of.
For folks' background, that haven't heard that, Title 50, Title 10, if you could lay that out.
Yeah, I'm sorry about that. The Title 50 is the part of the U.S. code that covers intelligence collection and intelligence gathering by military the military. Title 10 is our traditional warfighting capabilities. And under U.S. law, you know, we go to great lengths to separate, the intelligence collection from actual warfighting. And, you know, without getting into a long drawn out discussion on that, you know, there are a lot of background and reasons for that. But we have to understand that the North Koreans, the Russians, the Chinese, you know, our adversaries do not have legal machinations about whether or not, you know, what part of a particular side of the law they're on. I mean, this is all a form of information warfare, and they look at the entire spectrum of conflict, whether it's in the information realm, whether it's in the kinetic realm, whether it's in the diplomatic or economic realm. So policymakers have an opportunity to use this attack, I think, as a catalyst to have these real discussions and start addressing the questions, basically, who can do what, i.e., what can CyberCom do to defend not only the .mil domain, but also the rest of the country? What is the role of the Department of Homeland Security? What is the role of FBI? What sort of information can and should we be sharing with these private security firms, with corporations, with public utilities, with state and local governments? And how do we craft and create a coordinated response capability that is both resilient and nimble? Because everything that happens in cyberspace happens in nanosecond time. We don't have time to go out and stand up an OPT and start, you know, making PowerPoints to figure out what it is we're going to do. I'm sorry.
OPT.
I'm about to lose my commission and be kicked out of the Navy. I said, you know, but, but anyway, despite the blasphemy I just spoke, that's just the reality of the game today. So I hope policymakers use this as an opportunity. You know, what was done is done. And, you know, our responses are kind of limited to what we have. But now is the time to start planning for the next attacks. So this is seems like a good catalyst to me to start answering these questions. Sorry for being so long-winded.
No, that's quite all right. And I think it leads anyone listening. I think it is definitely worth, in this regard, trying to look into that personal view of where that line of war and what is crime and what's vandalism, et cetera, starts. There is a book called Unrestricted Warfare by two People's Liberation Army colonels. The translation's free online, but it talks about, and you know, this is an academic document. People argue whether or not this is how the Chinese military views its operations or even the scope of war. but it talks about different warfares, and it talks about using the law as warfare, or about using warfare in all the areas. Almost a flip on Mao's People's War, where in People's War, every man, woman, and child grabs a gun and goes to war. Instead, in this version, you use an entire society or state as a weapon. So someone, you may not be shooting at them, you may have not declared war, but you're using your economy, you're using other aspects that aren't necessarily conflict to destroy your enemy, and in your mind, you're at war. And I think that leads to that idea where, like, again, we talked about national security. One man's crime is, again, another man's national security threat. You could imagine what would happen if this happened to 5 or 10 American corporations or critical industries, or imagine if someone out there was able to blackmail 4 or 5 major, the CEOs of major media outlets, and how they could affect how the American people gain information or could gain access to other systems that they could damage. And then where does that lead? Where do you draw that line? And of course, I don't think we've answered that today, and that's going to take a lot more studying to figure out where that line is. But, we started off today's podcast talking about the effects of the interview, and we have thoroughly and justifiably segued completely off of that into a ditch somewhere. So as closing, I want to bring it roughly, very violently and roughly, back to the beginning. Haley, Natalie, who kindly lended you and Clay to me for this podcast, she mentioned that you had read some interesting reviews of the interview that you wanted to share.
Oh, sure, yeah. I really liked how Variety described watching the interview. They called it an alleged satire that's about as funny as a communist food shortage. And then they described it as cinematic waterboarding. And I think, you know, maybe North Korea did us a big favor by preventing us from seeing it for a little while, because there is a lot of comedy you can draw from North Korea, but I've heard really bad things about this film so far. So I'm hoping that there's something else that can come out and really rectify it.
Well, I will tell this to you and the audience. I watched it. I forced my family to watch it on Christmas because America, that's why. I'll tell you what. My mother likes to pretend that people don't swear. And she gets very shocked when someone says ass. She'll be like, oh, don't say that. Nobody says that. I'm like, Mom, come on. You watch television. She even sat through it. It took a little while to get her to sit down. She's like, this is ridiculous. I've heard the F-bomb like 8 times. but she thought it was funny. My whole family thought it was funny. It's ridiculous. It's silly. And I'm glad you brought up a review from Variety, because professional critics, they can never sit down and just enjoy themselves and appreciate something for what it is. They're like, wait a minute, this isn't Alfred Hitchcock. This isn't Kubrick. This isn't 2001. No, it has no pretense. It's two dudes having a silly movie. So, you know what? If you don't take yourself too seriously, I say to the audience, go ahead and see it. It's fun. It should be fun. Is there anything else that anybody would like to close with, or any thoughts, final inklings of inspiration before we close it out for the day?
I just want to make a quick comment that, the Russians recently came out and made a statement regarding the interview and supporting North Korea. And I know we kind of left the Russians out of the conversation here, but they took an interesting position saying that, you know, for the United States to allow movies to be made which depict assassinations, it's going to, and for an authoritarian regime like Russia, they're probably sending a pretty clear message that any future movies which might pretend to have a plot line of assassinating Mr. Putin would be taken under probably pretty dire feelings. So I just thought it was very interesting, the Russian approach and response to all of this. And then they turned around and invited Kim Jong-un on his first diplomatic trip anywhere. In fact, he's never been to Beijing, but he's going to Moscow. Just interesting.
Good. I just sort of on that, you know, remember 2006, there was a British film about the assassination of George W. Bush. So it's interesting to hear, you know, hear that reaction to our media when we do, when essentially we let people do it to us. But of course, you know, we're not the secret, subtle, totally not, but actually our Soviet Union. So it's a little bit different.
Exactly. Yeah, it goes back to the point. Sorry, it goes back to the point about cyber vandalism, I guess, pushing the definition of what's an act of war. Is like, at what point does a movie become an act of war?
Unless a warehouse explodes, I don't think you get to call a movie an act. I see where you're going with there, and it does lend itself to that concept of unrestricted warfare. If you know you manage to produce in some sort of insane alternate universe a movie that would bring a country to its knees, someone could potentially view that, I guess, as or an act of war, as you've done the equivalent of a military. So I mean, it's such a great, it's very unsettling sometimes. It's the difference between looking at things realistically and I would almost say looking at them safely. Is how do I view war? Because it's war, such a terrible thing. Does it become so broad as that the results of my following definition become something I prefer not to live with? You know, I don't know. You know, it's a lot to think about. The cyber warfare is definitely, as good as the term is, definitely brings that out. So everyone who's listening knows I randomly cut this out of the end of the podcast when we were just talking about random stuff, because Haley here has a 15-second pitch for the Kim Jong-il or Kim Jong-un being the ultimate Bond villain.
Well,
go.
Kim Jong-il was alleged to have had at least 8 palaces with golf courses, horse stables, garages full of motorcycles and Mercedes-Benz, shooting ranges, swimming pools, funfair parks, and hunting grounds stocked with wild deer and duck. And he allegedly imported 350,000 pounds of cognac a year, ate lobster and caviar and sushi, and of course, he only ever traveled in his private train because he was afraid of flying. So I think if that doesn't qualify him and his son for the ultimate Bond villain, I don't know what does.
Two things on that. One, Bond villains fly around a lot. So the whole fear of flying thing, I mean, maybe it's a cool weakness that Bond can use against him, but it also prevents him from flying around. And
you can't kill him if he's flying, you know, you can't crash his plane, so he's harder to kill.
That's true. But he's got a train, and trains don't have a good track record.
Yes. Haley, how many unicorns did he have?
Oh, a few of those. He just keeps his wild unicorns out in his hunting ranges for him to hunt.
And he's actually the smartest and the most handsome of all of the unicorns.
Oh, yeah.
So, did you say funfair park?
That's what they call them. A funfair park. Like, I imagine
what does that even mean?
'60s.
Okay, you need to explain to me what you imagine from the '60s, because I don't know what a '60s funfair park.
I think it's, you know, when you've got carnival games and rides and roller coasters, that sort of thing.
We have those. Those are
like a midway.
2014.
Isn't that what we call them, Matt?
A midway. Boardwalk.
A midway. Yeah.
Where are you from? No.
All right. So had several thousand people dig a small sea in the middle of North Korea so that he could build a boardwalk for him to walk up and down and eat cotton candy while he'll starve to death. That makes it good for Bond villain.
Didn't he launch a satellite just to have it broadcast radio signal, like sing him songs at night or something?
I think you are referencing the, what is it, Homeland or whatever that video game was. What was that terrible video game that was supposed to be China but then turned into North Korea because China
the Red
was
Dawn
getting
remake.
Mad?
There,
yeah, Red Dawn.
Well, there was the Red Dawn remake before that.
Oh,
they
yeah.
had Homefront. There's a video game called Homefront where it was supposed to be China's invasion of the United States, and then they just ruined it by making it North Korea, and you're like, no. North Korea takes over the United States.
Yeah, but the reason they make it North Korea is so that they've got another billion people to watch their movie or play their game.
I realize this, but it's killing me. Like, this. Like, guys, let's make it Russia again, then. Seriously, because
Cuba,
you
right?
may as
and
well...
Over again.
Right. Jeez, go back to Chuck Norris's Invasion USA.
Oh, yeah, they're our friends now.
Yeah, well, that is another podcast that I need to get into. But, okay, so clearly I'm going to add this, and I guess back to your regularly scheduled programming. I don't even know where I'm going to put this in the podcast.
Just replace the whole thing with that.
Just... Well, that's as good as any. Well, I want to thank all three of you for joining me today in our rip-roaring ride all across the road and not staying particularly on topic for too long in any particularly one area. You are listening to the Sea Control Podcast from the Center for International Maritime Security. You can follow us at CIMSEC. And, of course, my two friends. I can call you friends, right? I've been too much of a jerk.
Of course.
Right? Lovely. Okay, Haley Janner and Clay Aiken from the Australian Strategic Policy Institute, ASPI, provided to us, of course, by Natalie Samby, who on Twitter is at Security Scholar. And Haley and Clay, do you guys have a Twitter handle we can follow yet?
Yeah, I'm at @A_KLEE.
And no, I'm a Twitter recluse, so I don't have anything. I'm staying away from it.
Your life, trust me, your life is much better for it. And ASPI is at ASPI_ORG, correct? Bingo, okay. And Jake, you don't have anything, right? You're just kind of floating out there.
I'm too busy reading your emails.
Oh, that's true. Yes.
Yeah, I'm on Twitter. It's at jakebeber.com or at Jake.
Or you can just email your friends.
Don't worry.
Hey,
the chip we implanted in your head, I'm able to read all your thoughts anyway.
Yeah, I mean, cut out the middleman. You know, the hands are a sloppy tool to just interpret the products of the brain. All right, well, everyone, thank you for listening to us today. Thanks for joining us.
My God, if I want to lob some code downrange, it's like, oh, geez, you might blow up the internet.